You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
We're joined again with the authors of the book From the Volcano to the Gorge, Getting the Job Done on Iwo Jima, Raymond Z. Miller and Howard N. McLaughlin, Jr. Gentlemen, thanks for coming back and doing it all over again.
We appreciate
the pleasure. It's a pleasure.
Okay, the last time we spoke, we talked about your beginnings and pretty much leading up to February 19th, 1945. Ray, you left the Marine Corps as a sergeant, and you were with the 5th Marine Division, 28th Marine Regiment. You were an armorer, which means you took care of the weapons and, I guess, distributed the weapons, right?
Yeah, and repaired and that sort of stuff, but not on the island.
Right. You were a rifleman.
There was nothing for me to do armorer-wise on the island. So I was a spare part, and they would use me wherever they needed another body.
That's right. And I want to actually get into that in a little bit, the spare part stuff, because I have that written down. That's important. Howard, you were a, I guess, private first class in the Marines?
In the combat time on Iwo Jima, yes. Right after that, I left and went from the 5th Engineer Battalion to the 2nd Engineer Battalion, the 2nd Aviation Engineer Battalion, and the 1st Aviation Engineer Battalion. By that time, I was a sergeant also.
Good for you, Sarge.
You guys just said something that brought me back to the book. Ray, you said something about the spare part. Did you know that you were a spare part before you got to Iwo Jima? Did they classify you as a spare part?
I didn't, but then again, I was wondering what I was going to be doing on the island, and I'd asked the questions of some of the people that knew, and I guess they led me to believe that I wouldn't be having my armory or the armory tent or be repairing weapons or anything like that. They didn't really tell me that I was going to be a spare part, but I knew that I was going to do whatever I was asked to do because the armory was back there, and I had a weapon, and if you needed another weapon, you can pick one up off the ground. So I didn't really know, but to help answer the question more fully, I was there at Camp Pendleton also, and we were training, and there's a joke. I talked with a number of other fellows from Iwo Jima in the past, and we kind of joked about this, that we all went to boot camp, and then they sent us to Iwo Jima for training.
Right. Well, that's true, right?
When we were in training in Pendleton, my duties as an armorer didn't really occupy an awful lot of time. And I would be sent off to this school or that school to come back and relay that information to the other guys. I would be out working in one of the line companies and learning the moves and what we needed to do. And I worked with the demolition fellows and with the mortar sections. And they kept me busy. And I was learning a lot because, well, I guess when I got to the island, I found out that I'd learned a lot of what I needed to do.
Right. So let the listeners know exactly what is a spare part, give them the definition of a spare part.
Well, there were a number of us that had specific duties back in camp, like the cooks and sometimes the truck driver and some of the others who were not necessarily in a rifle platoon, but they were doing other things there that they weren't going to be doing in combat. The cooks, we had a couple of cooks. I remember seeing them. They put them up in the line to fill in holes in the line, and some of the other fellows that actually were not in a rifle platoon would be used wherever they could use. I'd be sent to do this, that, or the other thing, and I did that.
Right.
So I was not doing what I had been doing before.
Right.
And that was true for a lot of others, too. We weren't driving any trucks there. Every Marine is a rifleman.
Right.
And so if you need a rifleman up there in the line, and we needed a lot, we were losing men every day. And so we would fill in the holes in the line. Sometimes those lines got awful thin.
Right. So the primary duty of a Marine is a rifleman, as both of you said in the book.
Yes,
right?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Howard, you also were in a similar category as Ray because, as you say here on page 6, in the eyes of the real Marines, company engineers and mechanics in particular were in a category even lower than cooks and bakers.
That's right. That's exactly where we stood because they knew that that's what they were going to do. While they were still doing cook and baker stuff and training with the infantry, we were running our equipment. We were repairing roads and whatnot in Pendleton. Basically, it was training. Whether you're running an Alice Chalmers or a Caterpillar tractor, there's not that much difference, but it's nice to be familiar with them.
Right.
So when the time came, we were told that our particular group, since we hadn't had any infantry training at all, other than the night marches, we were told that we were going to just sit this one out and be ready to land on the next landing, which was going to be Okinawa. Okay, we got started on this, And when the time came for the actual landing on Iwo Jima, our group was sitting topside, 9 o'clock with the landing. We sat up there and watched them through the field glasses. We had no idea what was going to happen, that in 2 hours that we would be the people that would be up on the beach and somebody else would be watching. So that was our introduction to combat, was about a few minutes before 11 to call everybody topside and pick some of us out. And we were supernumeraries. We were sent off to the beach. We had no idea what units we were going to or anything. We were sent. And when you got there, why, the beach master was the one that determined where we went and what we did. And that was the way it worked out.
Right.
That was the reason, of all places, that I ended up on Suribachi on the first afternoon. Well, we got there probably 2 o'clock. I was up in Suribachi. I had no idea what I was doing or why I was up there, but, you know, here I am.
Right.
They decided up there that we weren't the engineers that they wanted, which were demolition people, and they sent us back down to the beachmaster. So we worked for him until about 4:30, 5 o'clock before we dug in for the night. That was our whole training, was walking across from the beach up to Suribachi. I guess that was about our first combat training we really had.
Right, on page 5, you said you weren't even supposed to go ashore, as you explained. And then on page 14, you say that as the fifth wave landed, the euphoria aboard the ships began to evaporate. So how did you feel before you actually came ashore?
Of course, I'm sorry to see it going bad, because there was a lot of people up on the beach. But no reason for me to worry, because I was a combat person. And that's why I say that all changed in just a few minutes. I went from somebody who was a mechanic to an infantryman.
Right. But were you euphoric about landing?
Being 18 years old and stupid, yeah. Because I still was thinking of, I don't remember what other movies I'd seen, but you see these things of the Marines running up the beaches and whatnot. I guess I'd seen the combat footage of Taro, and maybe that was, what's it like? Just one of those things that you, at that age at least, that you have to do. I have to find out for myself.
Right. And they gave you a good breakfast on board, didn't they, Ray?
Yeah, we called that the Last Supper.
Howard, same thing happened on your landing craft, right?
We didn't really prepare for it, because while they were unloading their first couple rounds of troops off our transport, we were down in the holds getting equipment untied, chains down, gas tanks full, and all that kind of stuff. And we knew that we were going to be there for lunch, so it didn't make that big a deal. Lunch about 2 days later, but anyway.
Right. The landing on the beach, here on page 29, Howard, you say that the sand was very dark gray, almost black, a coarse yet almost slippery volcanic ash. What about that sand do you remember, like trying to move through the sand?
Well, the first thing that happened, of course, is you always think about the coxswain that's running your landing craft, which, by the way, I don't think they ever got any real thank yous for it. A lot of those people were Coast Guardsmen that were running those landing craft. They didn't have enough Navy people that knew how to operate them. But anyway, you wonder, well, say it, Tarawa. And you look at those things, and the guy opens the door and kicks them out, and the people are gone forever. There's too much equipment on them. They go under. It's too deep. When we got to Iwo and the guy, the coxswain, dropped the ramp, we stepped out on sand. He was far enough up that we had nice, hard-packed sand. And you got up there another 15, 20 feet, you got out there where it was damp, you got into the dry sand, and you'd sink well above your ankles. There was no traction, no real footing that you could get in it. You were wallowing in the mud, I guess is the word for it.
How about you, Ray? Did you experience something similar to that?
Oh, yeah. Actually, when the ramp went down on the landing craft, that signaled the beginning of the war for me. But we ran down the ramp. They said, move it out. They ran down the ramp, and where the sand was wet near the water, it was much more solid. And like Howard said, another 15, 20 feet or something like that, it was dry. And it was kind of steep getting up off the beach, but I like to say that it was like trying to run through talcum powder. You just about can't run. You do the best you can to move forward.
Right. And here you are. You got bullets whizzing over your head, shells exploding everywhere.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot going on. Yes, sir.
From that place you were dropped off at the beach, too, you said like 10, 15, 20 feet you hit that soft sand. And then, of course, you finally made it over that ridge to start climbing Mount Suribachi. Were there a lot of your friends and fellow Marines getting got at and...
Oh, I guess so.
Killed right in front of your face?
Right there. Dropping like flies, you could say, because you could hear it. hear that noise all the time. That's bullets. And they're chirping. They're chirping, and they were firing at us. There was some mortar fire coming down there. Oh, yeah, but once we got up, and it took a while to get up over two or three different terraces of the beach, and then it was good solid land up there. And our instructions were to just keep moving straight forward, and we were to rendezvous, I don't know, 500-600 yards from the beach, and our company was to rendezvous there, and we finally did. But getting there was tough.
Right.
I jumped into a shell hole. It wasn't too deep, but I jumped into a shell hole when I heard a lot of firing. And then there were mortar blasts, and I jumped into this shell hole, which was maybe 6 or 7 feet deep. And I had mentioned in the book somehow that this machine gun fire was knocking the edge off of one side of the shell hole and was kind of lining the other, and we were underneath the trajectory of the bullets. I was fortunate enough that one of the gunnery sergeants was in there, and he'd been through some of this stuff before, and it was all new to me, even though we'd practiced all of this. This was the real deal, and in getting off the beach, the gunnery sergeant, of course, we called him Gunny, that was their nickname, there were planes strafing Suribachi, because there were a lot of caves in Suribachi and guns there. The planes would be strafing Suribachi, and then a number of the planes would be dropping napalm. Then we found out pretty soon, and the sergeant had this figured out, that when the planes were on their glide path to Suribachi, the Nips knew that they were going to get a bath of fire, so they would go back into their caves and their emplacements, and the firing would stop for maybe 15, 20 seconds or something like that, and that was the time to get up and run for a while and then find a hole or lay flat when the firing resumed. So the fact that the planes were strafing and dropping a lot of napalm, by the way, is jelly gasoline, and it's just like having oil on fire or something like that. And that got them back from the openings of the caves where a lot of the firing was coming from.
Mm-hmm. How old were you again?
I was 20. As a matter of fact, I had my 21st birthday on the island.
Howard, when you hit the beach and you started to march forward for cover.
Nobody marched. You ran as fast as you could. You were getting any place, but you were running. Right as the ramp went down, as I stepped off onto the sand, you come off of those little boats in lines of three, okay? And the kid next to me in the middle got hit and went down. That's my first introduction to combat. What, 3 steps into the island? You could see the little jets of sand being kicked into the air by the bullets as they hit the sand. In my about 3 travels up and down from the beach, the thing we had been tasked to do as we got off the landing craft was to come back and get the C2, which is a demolition explosive, more explosive than TNT. So on those trips back and forth, I got knocked down by concussion several times. The only thing was that nice dry sand absorbed those mortar shells or high explosive shells. At that time, I wasn't versed enough in knowing which was which. You'd get the concussion from the explosion, but the way they buried themselves in the sand when the shell exploded, it threw everything directly into the air, and we weren't getting the shrapnel from there. We were getting shrapnel, but it was from down the beach someplace. That was coming back down on us. You're getting us 2 ways.
Right. I just want to explain to the listeners about Iwo Jima, and this is from page 224. This is from Ray's part of the book, chapter 4. It says, we needed this island 800 miles from the Japanese homeland as a base for fighter planes to escort our bombers on missions. In addition, Iwo Jima would be a much nearer place for damaged bombers to land if they could not make it back to their bases. So Iwo Jima was obviously an important strategic position for the Americans during World War II. You guys agree with that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
Ah.
After years and whatnot, and there's a pretty good book out, it's called The Ghosts of Iwo Jima.
Okay.
And it's talking about how once the island was taken, how little use they had for it. The Air Force was all hot for it until we had lost all those people. And then they changed their mind and they really didn't care. They went on to Okinawa and built their air bases. It ended up, it was not what it was supposed to be.
As they say, history is written by the victors, right?
Yeah, right.
It's not until many years later that new items are uncovered, and it happens all the time. And of course, there are documents that are classified, and they're not even going to be opened in 50 years, even though they happened 50 years ago. I know there are some World War II documents that are still classified. I think something like 60 million pages are classified. You got to wonder why.
Right. You don't know that when you're running up the beach, but like you say, it's 50 years later that you begin to find these things out. So that's changed my outlook on it. All we were doing was being, I guess, sacrifices is the only thing I can think of for something that wasn't well thought out.
Right. And of course, you say on page 12, Howard, that as the Navy had said all along, it just didn't seem possible that there could be anybody alive on that island after all the shelling.
Right.
Navy's done that plenty of times before. They thought that they had taken everybody out, but in fact, there wasn't the amount of shelling beyond the beaches that you think there should have been.
Right.
Ray, have you explored this topic at all?
My feeling is that it was a very important thing to do, and if somehow it doesn't seem to fit into others' expectations, it was a hell of a good idea because we were able to get our fighter planes along with the bombers. I think one of the things that wasn't talked about too much at that time when we were bombing Japan, which everybody thought that was wonderful, bomb them into submission, there's an awful lot of those bombers every night that went out with crews and didn't come back. They caught hell over Japan, and we had fighter escorts with them that would have made an awful lot of difference.
Mm-hmm. One of the most refreshing parts of the book is that you guys really look at what you went through completely different lenses. And that's great, because if you both felt the same way, then it would be a much different book. But there were two ways of looking at what you went through and two ways of looking at how you feel right now.
They had a month of bombing every day with bombers coming over there and dropping high explosives. And then there were the 3 days of naval bombardment just prior to the actual invasion. Now, one of the things that no one seemed to know, later on we talked about the lack of intelligence of what was going on. All that bombing, the way I described it, it would move dirt from one place to another.
Right.
And just about everything was underground. I saw one gun emplacement, and there may have been more, that must have received a direct hit or a couple of direct hits from some heavy stuff. And the top of it was gone. Everything else was underground. And actually, the Japanese command post in Hill 362, I think that went down 7 stories. There were pillboxes and blockhouses all over the place, and the Japs were using caves, and they would roll a gun up to the entrance of the cave and fire at us, and then roll it back in the cave until they were ready to do it again. I don't think the preliminary bombardment killed too many Japanese. They were all underground. And they were in concrete blockhouses and concrete emplacements. Not only did we not kill too many Japanese beforehand, but when you were there, and this is one of the toughest parts of it that I know, they could see us, we couldn't see them.
Right.
And so we're going to shoot. Now, we had ways of attacking the pillboxes, and we'd practice that. And you get men to do the right thing on attacking one pillbox, but there's another pillbox over there with machine guns, and they're covering the pillbox you're attacking. And you better do it fast and be lucky, or you're not going to be alive. I saw actually very few Japanese. They're all underground, and they're shooting at me, and I can't see them.
Right.
I'll buy that.
What's that, Howard?
I said, I will buy that there was, other than those, what, 2 or 3 Japs we saw coming up the draw off of the beach were the only Japs I saw, either alive or dead, for about, I don't know, probably 4 or 5 days.
Mm.
They were all very well camouflaged, which is what we had been trying to teach in school back in Pendleton. We just weren't teaching it in the right way, that's all.
Well, they had a lot of time to dig in there, right?
Right. We did ourselves a great injustice by what they bombed at for 84 days or something like that. That sort of gave the Japs a clue that we were going to do something there, so they'd better dig in. So by the time that they got there with the infantry, the Japs were all dug in. We cut our nose off to spite our face.
Right.
Some of the information I read on the history of this, they say that they spent 4 decades fortifying that, digging tunnels and pouring concrete gun emplacements that you couldn't see. And Admiral Nimitz said that Iwo Jima was the most heavily fortified real estate on the planet. And our intelligence really wasn't all that intelligent. We were told, and maybe Howard heard the same story, we were told that we would go in there and we would really take the island in about 3 days, and another 7 days would be mopping up. And then army troops would come in and garrison the place. In 3 days, we'd hardly gotten started. So we didn't understand really what we were running into there, and that helped make it awful tough.
Right. Right.
The three-day business was what we got to. I don't remember that they said seven afterwards, but I remember the 3 days. That stuck in my mind when on about the third day, and I looked back behind me, and those people back there that were firing on Suribachi, by this time I was turning around, I was going up with the 27th Marines. We were both in the same hole firing in different directions and got many farther than that.
And of course, this was February 19th, 1945. You guys dug in and did what you were doing until the day that they raised the flag on Iwo Jima, which, according to what I'm looking at here, was February 23rd, 1945, and that was 4 days after you got there. Ray, you saw this, right?
Oh, yeah. I was about 350, 400 yards away from the top of Suribachi. We were there at that very narrow neck of the island, just north of Suribachi. And at least for a couple of days, we didn't move. And I could see some of the caves on Suribachi where they would roll up a gun to the mouth of the cave and shoot at us. And I could see the muzzle flash. We were just standing by, but doing what we could. We had patrols out. I got a hold of some tracers. I was starting to shoot at this cave, and I was getting pretty good at hitting the cave. I don't think I killed anybody, but I let them know that somebody was shooting at them, and I did that for a couple of days. At least gave me something to do while we were there holding that particular line, and then there were plans for others to be going up onto Suribachi.
Mm-hmm. And Howard, did you see the flag being raised?
Oh, yeah. I think everybody on the island. I was up at the end of the south end of the first airstrip, and we were still up there. We were cleaning up the area that had been deloused, I guess is a good word for it, on the first day. You had to go along this kind of a rush, that manzanita type of thing that was going around there. As the wind would blow, it would blow up around it and make mounds out of it. And we had to go back through that area and actually probe it like you were probing for mines, fire into it, whatever it was we were looking for. The Japs were camouflaged in under these little mounds of dirt, and yet they'd stay in there for a couple of days before they'd ever come out and start firing into the backs of the Marines ahead of them.
Strange.
That was sort of ironic. Here we were raising the flag up there on the top, and yet we had cleaned up the rug, so to speak, underneath them.
Right. Do you think that the flag was being raised because they said, well, we want to do it in 3 days and let's get the flag up there? They missed it by 1 day, but do you think that had something to do with it?
I don't think so. I think the object is always to raise the flag. And when we got the chance, we raised the flag.
Yeah, we'd pretty much taken the mountain.
Yeah.
Most of the resistance was gone. 40 men went up there. There was some firing when they went up there, but not a lot. Most of the Japs had been killed or still hiding down in caves and tunnels.
Right. The photograph that I'm alluding to is called Raising the Flag on Iwo Jima. It is considered to be one of the most significant and recognizable images of World War II, and according to many, possibly the most reproduced photograph of all time. Now, I'm looking at it right now on my computer, but both of you guys actually saw that live.
What I saw was not the flag you're looking at. I saw the first flag that went up. It was a little tiny flag. It was 3 by 5 feet or something like that. We watched that go up, and we went back to our business, and we found out, when was it, 2, 3, 4 months later, that the picture that Joe Rosenthal had taken was the second flag. We didn't know there was a second flag. We were happy that they got the first one up there.
Hmm.
I remember quite a cheer going up when the flag went up. I think there were at least hundreds of Marines that were there and saw that and cheered. Then they went back to get down to the ground again, because you can't stand up too long and stay alive.
Right.
Out in the ocean around us, the ships were blowing whistles and firing big guns and all kinds of calliope for one or both of those. I can't distinguish the second one, but the first one, that was the one that made the impression on me.
It says here on page 62 that it was small, but we could all see it even without field glasses. It was shortly replaced by a bigger flag, as shown in the famous photograph. And you say here, Howard, that there was cheering all around us. Even the most cynical Marine who witnessed our flag being raised on Suribachi was touched deeply by the sight. It may be hard for people today to realize the pride we had in our country's flag. What do you mean by that?
Well, look at the support that the troops are getting in Iraq and Afghanistan and whatnot, and compare that with the support that the troops got in 1943, 1944 from the people here in the United States. Two different worlds.
What kind of support did you get back then?
You didn't get the support out there. You got the support back here. Take Camp Pendleton on Saturday morning. As soon as they had inspection, they'd turn the people loose and they could go to San Diego or Los Angeles or Hollywood or all these places, and you'd go out to the highway, and as far as you could see were this greenish color tinge along the edge of the highway, maybe 2 and 3, 4 Marines deep out there. They're all thumbing a ride to Hollywood. Every car that went by, unless it had already picked somebody up, would stop and pick up 1, 2, whatever number of Marines they could carry and take them into town. People bought you drinks. If you got on the bus, the driver would put his hand over the meter so you couldn't pay for it.
Right.
People were behind their fighting men, and they are not, to me at least, are not behind them nowadays. And I think that that made a difference in your morale.
You think the way that the troops are being treated today is less favorably than when you guys were there? Is that what you're saying?
They haven't whipped up the enthusiasm for the war and the support of the fighting man that they had during World War II.
Of course, America was a lot different back then, but that was, I guess, the last war that was a declared war. And I guess a lot of people might think that that was a just war compared to these actions that they're taking now, where no one has attacked the United States. Of course, the Japanese attacked the United States in Pearl Harbor, so striking back would be much more of a team effort.
That's a different war than we have today, and Vietnam was a different war, too. And we felt that we had been attacked, and actually, with a little historic perspective, the Japanese had really covered an awful lot of square miles in Southeast Asia. They were gradually taking over, and they controlled the shipping lanes, and they controlled the access to oil and rubber, and they were just getting larger and larger and more powerful, and they'd taken over parts of China, and they'd taken over Korea, and they'd actually had Japanese on 2 islands up in the Aleutians, and they were telling us, we're coming after you, and they had bombed Dutch Harbor up there. They knocked out, I guess, at least half of our Navy. And so we weren't in very good shape until we got people in the factories working. Everybody in the country, I think, had put their shoulder to the wheel, and we kind of knew that. I felt that we were being well supported in what we were doing and doing the best we could. There's another point I want to make, because 10 minutes ago someone mentioned about irony. I go and talk to people about this sometimes to help promote sales of the book, and I talk about the forgotten battle, and I mentioned that in 4 days we had taken Suribachi and the flag went up, and this was very dramatic, and of course that kind of means that you at least got in the high ground. I'm led to believe, but maybe this is my imagination, that back home here the people saw the pictures of the flag going up and figured, well, we've got that little island. You know, let's move on to the next thing. And I like to talk about the forgotten battle. And the forgotten battle was the next 31 days that we had to try to cover that island and try to move straight forward 20 or 30 yards or 60 or 70 yards in a day and stay alive. I don't think that we got, I guess, let's say the credit for all the tough stuff that we had to put up with there, because we lost an awful lot of men. There were many ways to say that it was tough, and I go out on speaking engagements, and I tell them what it means to be tough. Let me do this, if I may. Let me just take a moment to read what the Japanese had there. I copied this out of a book that's an authoritative book. It says the Japanese defenders were hidden deep in countless emplacements, caves, and pillboxes, all of which were mutually supporting. This is what they had for armament. This was counted afterward. 12 320-millimeter spigot mortars. 320 millimeters is pretty big. 22 150-millimeter trench mortars. 4 15-centimeter coast defense guns. 4 14-centimeter coast defense guns. 9 12-centimeter coast defense guns. 12 12-centimeter short coastal defense guns. 30 12-centimeter dual-purpose guns. 5 6 and 10-centimeter dual-purpose guns. 5 8-centimeter dual-purpose guns, 18 7.5-centimeter dual-purpose guns, 1 150-millimeter howitzer, 4 120-millimeter howitzers, 6 10-centimeter howitzers, 4 90-millimeter howitzers, 17 75-millimeter field guns, 24 70-millimeter battalion guns, 70 90-millimeter mortars, 380 50-millimeter grenade dischargers, 54 47-millimeter anti-tank guns, 15 37-millimeter anti-tank guns, 213 25-millimeter machine guns, 4 40-millimeter anti-aircraft guns, 9 23-millimeter anti-aircraft machine guns, 4 20-millimeter machine guns, 168 13-millimeter machine guns, 350 heavy machine guns, 480 light machine guns, 30 tanks, 61 flamethrowers, 10,000 rifles, 12 searchlights, 3 radar units, and 200-plus rocket launchers.
That's all?
That's all.
piece.
Yeah, but you're not counting the knee mortars in there, which were the real bitch.
That's kind of a misnomer, the knee mortar. You do that on your knee and you'd have a busted knee. Let me continue a little bit more. I've copied this right out of the 5th Marine Division history. The Japanese defenders were hidden deep in countless emplacements, caves, and pillboxes, all of which were mutually supporting. Suribachi's caves were as formidable as its pillboxes and blockhouses, 2 to 5 entrances, interconnecting tunnels linked with magazine and supply caves, some burrowed 50 feet below ground level from cave entrances, 6-inch guns pointed down the island.